Hello and welcome to this edition of the FitCast. This is episode number 256. I'm Kevin Larrabee and I got two guys with me today via Skype. First off, we have Alan Cosgrove. Alan, how you doing, man?
Hey, good, Kevin. Thanks for having me back.
And we also have Lou Schuler, who was also not exiled from the show. Lou, how you doing?
Good, Kevin, and thank you so much for not banning Alan. I know he deserved it.
Yeah,
you showed so much restraint.
Yeah, you know, I try. I'm a very forgiving person. I try to forgive and forget. But we are here to talk about the new rules of lifting for life, which is, first off, congratulations, guys, on the book. It has come out. It is tracking on Amazon today. We are talking on the day of its release. And you know what? The first thing I want to kind of throw out at you guys is a question we just like literally got from Andy via Twitter. We're using the social media to get some questions. And it's a good question. And feel free to either one of you can take it. If I own New Rules of Lifting, the original, and also New Rules of Lifting for Women, why should I buy the new one? What is new in the New Rules of Lifting for Life? So who would like to take that?
Well, I can start with that. With the first part is I started really as a full time trainer in the mid 90s after college. I taught martial arts classes from the 80s and became a trainer in the mid 90s. So we submitted New Rules of Lifting 1. The very original was delayed for quite a bit because we moved publishers. It was written in 2004, so 8 years of my career and several, you know, hundreds of thousands of training sessions have went by. So it's just different. You know, if it was a self-published book, this is one of those things where you'd probably not have the old one still available. It's still a good book, but it's just we've evolved so much as trainers in the past 8 years that my thought process on things are different. Like, there's just so much has changed. It's really hard for me to say what's similar about the two books, to be honest, because I feel like I'm constantly evolving and learning as a trainer and a person. And 8 years is, I mean, you think my career is probably only, you know, it's a third of my career as a trainer at least, right? And it's a third when I was already, you know, had a gym and a lot of clients. So there's a lot of changes. And it's also aimed more at, we used to think there's things that we thought in the past were correct and we were wrong. You know, things like, you know, the crunch argument and static stretching and aerobic training. There's things that we gave you our best stuff, you know, and I believe every person who writes a book gives you their best. But I'll say that, you know, my thoughts have changed on some things and this is the latest and greatest. And it's also aimed at, as Lou and I are 8 years older, it's also aimed at a slightly older population, I think. Lou?
Alan just gave a great answer, and I just want to add one thing. You know, our big innovation, what we thought was our biggest innovation with the original New Rules, was that the goal of it was to simplify training from, you know, these incredibly complicated schemes that, you know, I was helping to perpetuate because I was at the time, I was at Men's Health Magazine, and Alan knows as somebody who is contributing to magazines, we always wanted more complicated stuff. We always said, you know, we were always drilling down deeper. What can I do? You know, what's an exercise we can show that does this? So Alan's coming up with new exercises, new techniques. We're always making things more complicated. We're always increasing the volume of information that's out there. And so with this book, we thought, what if we simplify everything down, and if instead of showing 20 exercises to work a muscle group or a body part, what if we just narrow it down to movement patterns and show how all these exercises are connected, how there's basically six or seven movement patterns, and all these exercises, the best exercises, are the ones that work a specific movement pattern, which will carry over to something that you do outside the gym. So the one part, the one thing that's been consistent in all the books is that we focused on movement patterns. This, though, is the first time where we've shown you how Alan actually programs for his clients. So he'll start a workout with a new client with a template where he'll have the movement patterns penciled in, sets and reps, And the actual exercise selection depends on what the client actually can and can't do. So in this book, this is the first time we really open up Alan's playbook and we show how he progresses. So if somebody can start off at, say, level three of one particular exercise, like the squat movement pattern, you see, well, okay, if they can do this, then the next step is to do this, which is level four. The next step is level five. And some people won't get to level five on an exercise. Some people won't get to level three on an exercise. Some people will go in able to do level five right from the beginning, and they have to pick and choose whether some of these lower level movement patterns would be better suited to a particular part of the workout. So we leave this is the first time where we've really opened it up to the readers and said, okay, here's how Alan actually does it if you were his client. You can do this for yourself, or you could just take the workout as written, a sample workout as written, and you can just go to the gym and do that, and that's perfectly fine. But if you want to get as close as you can to the experience of having a trainer design this specifically for you, well, here's how a real trainer does it.
Remember too, Kevin, that when we wrote the first book, it was honestly the very first book for the mainstream. It was designed to be it was going to be called Basic Training originally. It was designed to be a new beginner's book, but it was the first book for the end user at the time that focused on movement patterns and not muscle groups. Mm-hmm. So at that time, it was kind of I don't want to say a quantum leap forward. Other coaches were using that, and guys in the training field and, you know, speaking at conferences were talking about that with their athletes, but it never had been like a sort of general fitness book. So this was the first one to do that. So, and this book, I think, is maybe the first completely customizable workout program where you can select your own exercises based on things. So it's very different just based on the changes, but it also the delivery systems change quite a lot too.
And then getting back to what Alan said, this is the first time where we've addressed a specific age group, and also not just an age group, but a specific type of trainee who has to make adjustments to a workout program, who can't do it exactly as written. You know, I mean, just using myself as an example, I'm 55 years old, and I haven't been able to do a barbell bench press on a flat bench probably at least 5 years. I haven't been able to do a back squat. I had hernia surgery a couple of years ago, and I've never risked doing a back squat since then because I know that I'll load it up with too much weight and re-injure myself. So for readers who have specific problems, have specific issues, whether it's an elbow or an ankle or a shoulder, well, here we give you this list of exercises. If this one is uncomfortable, if this one hurts, or if if it feels awkward, you're not ready for it yet, go down the line. You know, if level three doesn't work, try level two. If that doesn't work, try level one. Or if level three is too easy, try level four, try level five. So we're giving people all these options, hoping that the people who actually need the book, the people who have injuries or they're coming back from illnesses, or maybe they're extremely overweight and a lot of exercises just don't work for them because of their body shape. Well, now here they can work around their own problems with this guide. So we're telling you all the aspects of it that we're really excited about. And I hope this, you know, doesn't come off as too effusive, but we really worked our butts off on this one, and we hope people like it.
Yeah, I really don't think you can underemphasize the breakdown of the progressions and the regressions that you guys put into the book, because that is something that tends to go overlooked. When someone is selling a program, it is just here are the exercises, go have fun. If you can't do them, oh well, you know. So that was just one of the things that really stood out to me, and I think people really get a lot out of. So Andy, hopefully that answers your question. And Lou, you kind of alluded to this a little bit, and I feel like you almost talked about it last time we talked, but can you talk about the significance behind calling it the New Rules of Lifting for Life opposed to the New Rules of Lifting for women or for abs? It seems, like I said, like you talked a little bit about this last time we did an interview.
Well, you know, it's funny. I thought that was like a placeholder title. And I had a contest with the readers, with the people on my newsletter list. And I said, I'll send you a free book. Anything I've got on my shelf, I'll pull it off and send it to whoever picks what we decide is the best title. So two different people came up with the new rules of lifting for everybody, you know, two words, everybody. And I thought, oh, that is perfect. That's exactly what Alan and I are trying to do with this book. Because it's not just for middle-aged people. It's not just for injured people. It's not just for overweight people. It's sort of for everybody who has to make any modifications. So no matter what issues your body has, this is your book. And, you know, the publisher whose judgment is I always trust, because when it comes to selling books, they know how to sell books. Or they know what sells and what doesn't, I should say. Mm-hmm. And they said, nah, we're going back to New Rules of Lifting for Life. So I ended up holding a contest where I rewarded the winners, and they actually don't win anything because we went back to the original title.
Yeah, it still works. Everyone wins.
Yeah, right. Everybody, either nobody wins or everybody wins, and I guess everybody does.
I think it's the last book too.
Life part makes sense. I mean, it's certainly anybody at any age can use this. A 16-year-old could use this as their first training guide. An 80-year-old could use this.
I think the part too, Kevin, that a lot of readers might not understand is Lou and I really have no. The first book was going to be called Basic Training. The second book was not going to be a New Rules of Lifting book. The third book was, I think we were going to use Core, and our agent wanted to change that because he's the same agent for Core Performance. Right. And the last one was going to be something else. We don't have a whole lot to say.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it's, you know, it seems like it's all worked out, though. You know, the New Rules of Lifting has been something that, you know, tons of people have referenced when emailing in, or, you know, it, again, when you kind of go to these Perform Better seminars, those things are flying off the table. So, I mean, definitely people are picking up on it. Alan, I want to ask you if you could discuss self-limiting exercises and kind of what they are, what the definition would be, and your implementation of them at Results.
The self-limiting exercise is a term I got from Gray Cook, who wrote the book Movement. Gray is a speaker on the Perform Better tour with me, and he'd mentioned it in his book, but he talked about it before. We were talking about sets and reps for certain corrective exercises, and he was showing me things that you would just do for reps or for time until you could no longer hold the stability position, for example. Like your body very clearly would, it's almost like an abort switch. Once you're doing it wrong, you get feedback. Okay, so a perfect example would be a bottoms up kettlebell shoulder press. So if your core, any stability goes, you're going to lose the kettlebell position. If your grip goes, shoulder stability goes, core stability goes, or anything like that goes, you're going to lose the kettlebell. At that point, the set is over. And with certain exercises done well, for example, a chin-up, there's a point where you just stop, or pushing a sled where you just stop. So we've used a lot of these, because if I said, let's do burpees or kettlebell swings, as many as you can, right? Or barbell curls. Well, the form breaks down before you can't do any more reps, right? So there's a technical breakdown, but you can still keep moving. Mm-hmm. Well, unless you've got a trainer or a coach watching you who says that's the end of the set, an end user perhaps doesn't know when the end of a set is. So self-limiting exercises, and good ones are like ropes and the sled, they give you immediate feedback when the set is over. So we use them quite a lot. Our idea was I could take you to failure, you know, to use a very broad term, to failure or your limit without risking any injury, because the exercise in and of itself can't be done wrong. So there are some, I mean, can a push-up be done wrong? Yes, it can, right? There's certain things, but there's certain exercises like, you know, jump rope, you can't really do it wrong. Once your feet don't get picked up, you know, you hit it wrong. The sled is great. When you can't push the sled anymore, it just stops, right? So you get immediate feedback. So it's a term that Gray used for corrective exercise, and then we kind of took it and ran with it with some other exercises, and it's been become quite a big part of our programming now, that we like to do that. It's hard to communicate because people always want to know how many sets and reps do I do. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, that's gonna the exercise will tell you with these, right? So it's real good with core stuff because you know you can just get up into a good position. A Turkish get up is another excellent choice because you get up or you don't get up, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so it gives us a lot of information based on that. So it came from Gray Cook. I have an article about it on my blog, and there's one in men's health, but it's still a new concept that we're playing with and fleshing it out. So watch this space. We'll bring out some more stuff.
Very cool. And you know, I am kind of sniping for some information because at My Ball Strength and Conditioning, we end up picking up a lot of what you guys do at Results with our adult groups and, you know, with our fat loss clients and stuff like that. Has there been any big changes in the last year, you know, with your groups? Have you made any modifications to your program that really stand out?
The biggest change, I don't know in terms of time, but the biggest change has definitely been we've really moved away from traditional interval training to a large extent, which was we always did. We still have a couple of the Woodway treadmills and we have a bunch of Airdyne bikes. We used to do all our interval training on traditional cardio machines. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue came there is that everything I was doing was to try to ramp up the metabolism without any muscular effect, right? The phrase I used was maximal metabolic disturbance with minimal muscular involvement. Mm-hmm. Like I kept trying to do that, but the only way to do it was to just get so much repetition, right? And a perfect example is a mile of running is approximately 100 calories burned, but it requires 1,500 plyometric reps. Mm-hmm. So if I'm doing that as an interval style, the reps are about the same, but the forces are higher because we're doing high volume work. So I just kept looking at it's 1,500 reps of pounding, right? And it's not deadly, it's not dangerous, but it's 1,500 reps of pounding the joints in order to get a metabolic effect. So I started looking at things like, well, what if I just did the same amount of time? But I did, for example, a kettlebell swing, maybe the battling ropes, and a sled push, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe add in a step up. So I do those four exercises. And let's say that my client does a 10-minute mile. I do those four exercises for a minute each, twice round. Well, that's a lot less reps. It might be only 10 to 12 reps, and it's spread over the whole body. And there's really very little impact or a lot less. So I was looking at maybe 100 total reps, right? Something like that, 100 to 200 total reps spread over the whole body at less than body weight loads. And we were getting similar heart rates and ventilation rates with clients. So metabolically, we were getting similar effects. And the fat loss results went up. Mm-hmm. So our biggest change has been really that now obviously we got clients who do triathlons. We just had a team do a mud run. We got a team training for a marathon. You've got to run sport specific at that point. But if the goal is just metabolic training, I think there's superior choices to traditional cardio at this point. I was just hoping it would be, as with most things, we tested it and our goal was if this is as good as the traditional interval training, then we'll switch. Right,
yeah.
But it turned out to be better, and I haven't seen any downsides. The downsides I hear from people are, well, my client's form breaks down on certain exercises. Well, that's just bad coaching, though.
Yeah, exactly. Like
form can break down on anything.
Yeah,
right? That's not a reason to not. Like, have you watched some people run? You know, yeah. It's some people are kind of getting beat up with running, and I can see it even on the bike. So good technique is paramount regardless, but. That's been the biggest change there. The second thing would probably be we looked at a lot of things with aging populations, and for years the exercise science community thought that heart health was the most important thing. So we pushed aerobic training and cardiovascular work, and it helped. Then we started looking at that it was muscle, and it was they needed lean muscle, and that was the reason why they lost function. That their heart might be not the limiting factor. It might be their muscles and joints and strength for activities of daily living. So as a community, we all move towards strength training. But I think, having looked at it, I think the reason for power declines faster than lean mass in an aging population, their ability to produce power. And my theory is that the reason we lose muscle mass is that the body's nervous system doesn't require it to stick around. So we lose muscle mass and then we lose conditioning. So maybe power training for an aging population is a is an overlooked, and a lot of people, I don't know if people are overlooking it, but we definitely are emphasizing it more and more in our programming now, that we make sure every workout has a power component to it.
You brought up a great point with the metabolic training, and that's one thing that I've been kind of playing around with in terms of trying to, and maybe you have some ideas about this, but trying to really match the, you know, the heart rates that we'll see in a competitive atmosphere. Lou and I were talking about him playing basketball when he was at Men's Health, and I've been playing some basketball at the local gym here, and my heart rate always gets you know, much higher when I'm in that competitive atmosphere, opposed to, you know, just jumping on the Aerodyne bike and doing a couple sprints. I can get, you know, a couple beats higher. Have you guys, you know, seen better results with the heart rate with the metabolic training than with just jumping on the bike?
Yeah, for sure. But I think this is cutting edge stuff you guys are getting right now, because I don't think I've gone on record with saying this yet. If I have you run a 10 meter shuttle, mm-hmm. You will burn X number of calories because you weigh X weight and it's a given distance and over a given time, right? Mm-hmm. If I have you do that in the chaos training style that Robert Dos Remedios popularized, mm-hmm. where you're going to run that same distance in the same time, but I'm not going to tell you when to change direction. I'm just going to shout, switch, switch. So you move, you don't know when you're going to move. You put more force into the ground when you don't know you're going to change direction than you do when you are. It's just it's tougher. It's your ability to change direction when you don't know you're going to, mm-hmm. right? So that ramps up metabolism. But now think of like a soccer player running down the field and he's at full speed, right? But instead of just running full speed, he's got to adjust his speed based on something else that's going on, some other input. Mm-hmm. So I think when you play basketball, you're changing direction when you don't know, but there's also a reactive component to that based on cognitive input that your brain has to make a decision, right? And that changes you metabolically. It's just why you can get, you'd be more exhausted doing an activity, I think, like that, mm-hmm. than you would in a closed environment. If I just said, right, you in your basketball game, you played for 20 minutes and you ran, you know, 3 miles, just do 3 miles in 20 minutes. It'll get you ready. It won't get you ready. Mm-hmm. Right, so I think that there's a part of maybe some type of games or reaction drills with even the adult population as a metabolic stimulus that requires a decision-making input. I watched an elite level mountain biker go through it was a drill Brett Jones had him do that required him to hold a position then half kneeling and do some core. And this guy was just, you know, his ventilation was up, he was sweating, and there's no way the guy's not cardiovascularly in shape to handle that position. He's strong. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it was just because he was in front of the crowd, it was nerves, right? There's just a lot of psychological input. So I think that there's a reactive component to metabolics that we're just starting to explore with, and things like the reaction ball and change of direction drills, I think will be the future for that area. I think the fat loss results that we're seeing now are the best we've ever seen. I don't think we're scratching the surface of what's possible.
Yeah, well, like you said, you know, things have changed so much over those 8 years. You know, what's 8 more years going to do? But Lou, I'm going to kind of throw it back to you, because you've been super quiet over there.
I'm practically taking notes here on what Alan's saying, because this is great stuff. I've never heard him talk about this before.
Exclusive.
Cutting edge stuff on the FitCast.
I love the part about, you know, taking people by surprise, because anytime you put an unpredictable element into a program, whether you're talking about sports or even real life, I'll tell you one story that has nothing to do with exercise. When I was at Men's Health, I went on a TV program in New York to talk about, you know, gadgets and gear and stuff. And I had a heart rate monitor, and I thought, well, I'll just wear this heart rate monitor on the air, so that, you know, we can, you know, see what my heart rate is. I'll just sort of pull that out. And I didn't do it because I put the heart rate monitor on as we were getting ready to go on the air, and I checked it, and I was like at 150 beats a minute, and I was sitting there. So, you know, it goes to show what, you know, when you throw a little performance anxiety in there, it definitely changes things.
Very cool. But again, kind of going back, Lou, would you say you kind of got this idea, you guys got the idea for the, you know, for the book, just, you know, kind of how, again, things were changing with your own lifting and kind of how is that shaped up now? Like, what does your current programming look like? Have you scaled things back or have you ramped things up in different areas?
Well, I think I'm honest in the book that I did not want to do a book for middle-aged people. I did not want to do a book for people with specific types of injuries because I thought you just expand exponentially as you get into every area. Well, here's what does somebody with a knee injury do? Well, you know, it depends on what's causing the knee injury. What do you do with the back injury? And I thought now, you know, we're getting into the realm of medical advice. And readers have been asking me for this over and over and over. And I resisted and resisted until we got the idea that we described, which is, you know, what if we let people decide for themselves what hurts, what doesn't, what they can and can't do. So the inspiration for the book was the readers themselves and realizing that there was a way to give them exactly what they were asking for. In my own workouts, you know, I'm honest about this. I haven't been able to do the workouts in the books as written because there's some exercises I just can't do. If there's a single leg squat in there, I just can't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, my knees really, the pain is just too much. So I was making all these adjustments, but I thought, well, I'm a professional, you know, I can make these adjustments. But, you know, now we open up the playbook and we show readers how to do it. And the great thing about writing this book is I realized that a lot of the adjustments I was making were stupid, you know, that there were much better ways that I could stick closer to the actual movement pattern. And I wasn't doing that. So now if you ask me what I'm doing today, I can't answer because it has to do with the programs for the next book, which, it's like why I don't go on, why I don't post training logs and stuff on the websites that, you know, where you have training logs. I love those websites, but if I put my own workouts up there, then they're going to see what the next book is.
Fair enough. All right. So I won't take up too much of your guys' time, but there are a couple more things I wanted to ask about. And it seems like these are kind of questions that we get back to every time we have you on, because I feel like you guys are kind of leaders in the industry. And I like to pick your brains on this kind of stuff, but with, you know, going into 2012 where supposedly the world's going to end, do you have any ideas on where we're going to be leading into if there is a 2013? Alan, you kind of alluded to some of that stuff, but how have you been seeing things change? And you know, you've definitely had a huge influence with your mentorship groups and, you know, talking on the Perform Better circuit and stuff like that. Do you see any trends that kind of left or are coming into 2013?
Well, I think the training-wise, we're going to see more customizable workout routines, hopefully. I would like it may be a technology thing that we'll customize workouts on the day during the session that we could tell. Like, imagine if we knew your exact level of how much cardio you needed today, how much strength you needed today, and how many sets and reps that would be. I think that the days of the original sort of stuff you got in the older books, which is here's the workout, it fits on one page, you do three sets of each of these exercises and just go down the page, I think that was, it's great, obviously it works, but is it effective? Yes, but can we do things better now? So this book has been the first where we're starting to get people the ability to customize workouts. I think the future is going to be more and more what does the workout of the future look like? Like, what is a training session in the future? And I think there's got to be something about immediate feedback. I think some of the external stimulus with the sort of cognitive input into metabolic workouts is going to be huge. And I think guys like Robert Dalshimedias have started to really elevate metabolic training and team sports training and reaction stuff. And I think I'm hoping to do that with some general population. I think that we're still, strength training can still be, and I don't mean just like powerlifting, Olympic lifting, strength training for general fitness is still really in its infancy. I'm a first generation trainer really. Like, we're not, Jack LaLanne was, I guess, the first ever, right? But this is really the first, there were no, when I was was coming through high school and college, there was no real trainers at gyms. Even then, they were, you know, maybe you got a group exercise instructor. So it's just a very young field. So I think that'll change. And I think commercially, we're going to see the death of the big box gym very shortly. I think smaller training centric places are going to be the future there. And what's going to happen with books, Lou? Well, books always exist. Yeah, I just didn't download to my brain.
Where's honestly, where's the audiobook?
Oh, who wants to hear us talk about Stranger?
I would love.
I mean, that's something you got to have on it, either on a page or a screen in front of you. But let me, you know, future of books. You know, to me, it doesn't matter if it's on a pad or on a page. I think that. I don't think the future of books is entirely a self-publishing model. I mean, I think what Alan and I do, it's certainly entrepreneurial. We certainly have full responsibility for coming up with our ideas, almost full responsibility for promoting the books when they come out. And we also, you know, we have full responsibility to deliver something good that's going to be, we have to be thinking 2-3 years in advance from the start of the project to the finish of the project, make sure that it's still something that moves the ball forward when it actually comes out, something that still serves the readers in a way that other products don't. So in that sense, we are, you know, we have to be really forward-thinking, entrepreneurial, thinking along about ourselves. But you can't get away from the importance of having curated content, which is that somebody picks and chooses what books get published by publishers, which ones are edited, which ones, are professionally designed. That's something that I don't think any one person will ever be able to perfect as well as having an outsider say, you know what, you got to cut this. This chapter doesn't work. You got to rewrite this. You know, having that somebody who's responsible for the final product other than you. But to get back to what Alan said about the future of the way we train, I mean, I'm 55 and I've been, you know, working out since I was 13. So, you know, I've had this full spectrum. I mean, when I was a teenager and I'd be out running for, you know, to get in shape for a sport, I would have people literally stop and say, "Hey, man, you need a ride?" I mean, they really thought I was trying to get somewhere. Nobody had, you know, they didn't know that people actually get out there and ran on roads to, you know, for some reason other than to get from one place to another. So I've had this whole spectrum of experience over the last 40 some years. And what I really hope goes away are exercise machines, you know, not the cable machines, but the, you know, these fixed arm press and row and crunch machines and back extension machines and arm curl machines. I want those things to go away. You know, gym memberships would cost less if those machines weren't in there. And, you know, and it's the funniest thing at my gym. I'll give a shout out to the Human Performance Center in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and to Chris and Brian, who are the head trainers there and who give us a place to shoot all our books. So that's not a gratuitous plug. These guys genuinely are part of our brand. You know, somebody in there will come up to me, somebody, a member of the gym, and they'll say, "Well, what should I do about this? What should I do about that?" And so I'll say, "Well, you know, I think, you know, if you did this, if you did that, you got to work on your mobility because you're really stiff through this range of motion." And 5 minutes later, I see him over there working on an arm curl machine. And I walk over to him and say, "Look, you just asked my advice. Here's my advice. Get off this machine. Don't sit on this machine. Don't exercise on this machine. If you want to work your arms, pick up a pair of dumbbells." So that's my take on the future of the fitness industry. I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but that's something I wish would happen. I wish those machines would go away.
Well, you got to think. I think the, or at least like to think that the population is starting to be a little bit more educated on the process because, you know, just using our facility as an example, we have seen more and more people come in here and saying, "Wow, there's no machines in here. Great, I want to train here." They're figuring out.
I don't like to be too negative about anything. I think the show, The Biggest Loser, despite some of its flaws, did a lot to.
Absolutely. Sort
of re-educate the public what a gym should look like because they have ropes and kettlebells and sandbags and sleds. And we were seeing that stuff despite, I mean, they had some other stuff, but there was a lot. When we first had ropes and kettlebells, people had never seen them before. Mm-hmm. And that was on a national television show. So the public, I think, is getting more educated. And I think it actually helps us because bad trainers and bad gyms can't survive anymore. The public's too smart.
It's but a good that sign. Said, and I agree with what Alan said, but that said, as long as the machines are there, people are going to use them, whether that's the best equipment for their purposes or not. And that's, you know, like I said, I understand why gyms have them. It's just that when the machines are there, people think they're supposed to use them, or they think that they're somehow going to get a better benefit from that machine than they'll get from doing the free weight versions. And I think, as Alan has proved, as so many good trainers have proved, you know, as the readers of our books have proved, you sure don't need those machines to get the results you want.
Yeah, I think it's the problem is still there is a little bit of a barrier to entry in terms of cost. Like, you know, with those gyms, you know, the machines being there and saying it's like the power circuit or something like that, where they can just go through those eight machines and say they got a workout. And that, what Alan's been doing with the semi-private model is making it a lot more, economically possible for, you know, just regular people to go in and get a coached experience instead of having to go and pay $90 for a 1 hour session with someone. And Alan, that's what you've alluded to quite a bit in your talks at, you know, Perform Better and stuff like that. So, we'd hope, you know, things are definitely changing. We're seeing it quite a bit. All right. So, the way I'd like to wrap this up is to, let everyone know, that the book is now on sale at amazon.com. You can head over there right now, and hopefully you're listening to this, on Thursday night and you are, on your iPhone, which has a great, Amazon app where you can just pick up the book on there. And, after you get it, check it out and please post a review for the book on amazon.com as well and spread the word. Definitely get the word out there about the book and, the whole family of New Rules of Lifting books. And, guys, do you have anything else before I wrap things up?
No, I thank everybody who's listening to this call, who's obviously interested in what we have to offer, and we'll keep bringing it.
Yeah, and Kevin, thanks so much. This was really fun, and I always appreciate the chance to come on your show.
My pleasure, and everyone, don't forget to check out the FitCast on iTunes and check out the FitCast.com for more podcasts and blogs and updates and stuff like that. Take care and have a great rest of the week.